All right, this is Rick with Big Foamy Head, and we are podcasting from Coors in Golden, Colorado. And I believe this is the first podcast from Coors.
Yes, it is.
And I'm here with Dana Johnson from, well, right now you're representing the Master Brewers Association of America.
Of the Americas, yeah, MBAA, and we're the Rocky Mountain District. And, you know, we this is the first, as you said, the first podcast from not only Coors, but it's the first podcast that I know of a MBAA meeting. So.
Okay, so this is a joint meeting, and you guys are with the Society, American Society for...
ASBC, it's the American Society of Brewing Chemists.
Brewing Chemists, there we go. Okay,
yeah.
I knew I was going to mess that one up.
Joint meeting, and their local section is called Section 8, so they're kind of crazy, but they're fun to hang with, too.
Okay, so this podcast is kind of inspired from the World Brewers Forum that we had before.
That's right.
And we hope that Steve Presley.
Yeah, Steve Presley from Anheuser-Busch.
Anheuser-Busch will be joining us. We missed him. He was one of the speakers at the World Brewers Forum. And today we're joined with, if you gentlemen don't mind introducing yourselves.
Troy Casey. I'm a pilot brewer at Miller Coors, and I'm here with a guy named...
Toby Eppard, and I'm a staff brewer with Miller Coors.
You are the pilot brewer.
Correct, Troy Casey, yeah, pilot
and,
brewer.
And why don't you tell us about the pilot brewery? It's a 30-barrel system, I believe.
Correct, yeah, we're a 30-barrel brew house in the just right next to the big brew house in Golden, here in Golden, Colorado. So we've got a 30-barrel brew house where we test and design new beers for the Coors and, as of currently, the Miller Coors portfolio. We test and package everything in-house, and we're currently doing our Herman Joseph's beer. So we are re-releasing Herman Joseph's as a new brand into the Denver area. So take a look for that.
Yeah, and
what
that's,
style is that?
That's an American amber lager category. That's where I would place it. But you know, personally. I don't really know what else to call it besides an American Amber Lager. So okay. I think that'd be a good thing to call it.
It tastes great. He brought some to the MBAA technical out-of-towner weekend up in Dillon in September, and really nice flavor. And so it's just around town at... White Table restaurants and
correct. If it's only available currently at about 30 accounts in the Denver metro area. If you go to HermanJosephs.com, you'll be able to find out exactly what places it's located right
okay.
now.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Were you sampling that tonight?
Unfortunately, tonight we're not sampling that. We've got a beer called a pre-prohibition version of Coors. It's the 1913 recipe of Coors. And so that's kind of what we wanted to showcase tonight to all the brewers that are here. So.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah. 1913 was when it started, right? Prohibition?
Prohibition, I don't remember. I think it started in 1919.
Yeah, and it ended in 1933, I believe.
The 21st Amendment got rid of that. And so this was a recipe that we pulled from the books, and we created it, and it's, you know, it's definitely... a little bit different than the current recipe that we have now. You know, maybe you think it's a little bit different or a little bit better, but we're a big fan of it, and we don't know what's going to happen to it, if it'll be released from whoever, but we like it in-house.
Okay, yeah. Maybe you can describe the process of how it goes from pilot brewery maybe to production release.
You know what? I'm going to let my friend Toby Eppard talk about that, because he used to work in the pilot brewery, but now he's a staff brewer, so he'll tell you about that.
Great, Troy. And that's a wonderful beer, pre-pro. Let's talk a little bit about kind of what is the market research cycle for a major American brewer, especially at Miller Coors. We actually have, believe it or not, the most expensive homebrew kit you will ever find in the world. We call it our Micron brew. It's about 26 liters, so it's roughly about 6 gallons. It cost us about, and this is almost embarrassing to say, about $80,000. Mm-hmm. Okay, now
that
if you think about
really nice homebrew system.
Yeah, you think about that a little bit.
I wonder if my wife would let me get one of those.
Yeah. Honey, please.
And when you think about that, it might feel like it might sound an awful lot, you know, pretty exorbitant. And Miller Coors has the money to do that, but it's really about doing, you know, the art of beer in a scientific way. because we have to make sure that we have reproducibility. It's almost like a laboratory setting. So let me set that stage for you. I mean, it's all copper-coated. It's steam-fired. It's controlled with computers and the whole nine yards, because from that, our marketing guys will say, hey, can you make this? You know, and in the Pilot Brewery, and Troy can attest to this for sure, is in my time, I mean, we made everything from lambics to saison to, I mean, great beer. We've done everything. One we did this one time was a peanut butter beer. It was a wonderful experience of scraping, you know, Jiffy peanut butter jars, but it was a great experience. But the total flexibility there. So our marketing guys will say, we think our consumer wants this. Mm-hmm. Can you guys make it? And Troy goes, yep, absolutely, we can do that. He salutes, he goes off and he grinds his materials, and he goes through basically a Coors, Miller Coors process. And he produces a batch, and then we get our marketing guys together about 7-8 weeks later, and they either go, dudes, I knew you could do it, or darn it, you know, you ought to try this, you know, a little bit better, we're thinking of something like that. But it's all about kind of zeroing in.
Yeah.
The idea being is that we control that system so well that our next step is to phase that up into the Pilot Brewery, which is a 30-barrel system, which I'm sure Troy's going to tell you all about here. But anyway, it's all about reproducibility. We get into the Pilot Brewery, and we make our batch of beer, and then from there, we might take that to consumers for sip testing. We might do that. In fact, Troy, I mean, you can vouch for this. We do all of them taste sampling in-house, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we're going to get not only the scientific look, but, you know, I can meet specifications with a beer, and it can taste like garbage. Okay, so it's not only about specifications. It's making sure that we actually, you know, have something that's great to taste and that consumers like.
Something mm-hmm. like a lambic is a 3-year blend, though. That's a pretty long-term investment. Are you guys geared towards that type of thing, or are you looking more for the shorter production runs?
You know, actually, that's when Troy just plays a little bit, and these guys, you know, they have some fun, you know. Mm-hmm. We always say if we're not having fun, we're not doing it right. So we do some of that stuff, and
well,
we put it in casks.
That's one of the best jobs to have. You got to play with and experiment with beer, right?
Yeah, so. If you guys could see Troy, he's smiling a mile
ahead.
Yeah,
he is.
Well, he got that UC Davis education. So.
The dream job.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
So building upon that, Rick, we come out of the Pilot Brewery, and then we can go directly to production with anything that we make. Okay. So, it's kind of neat. Troy's got the gem job. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Okay, I was going to ask you about the Sandlot. Do you want to talk about that? That's the brewery at Coors Field, which is the Rockies baseball team.
Yeah, in my time in the Pilot Brewery, which was 4 years in the mid-90s, the idea was to have a baseball park brewery, or a brewery in a baseball park. And so we opened up the Sandlot Brewery, and I believe it's a Newlands system. And it's a 10-barrel cast out with a 20-barrel fermentation system. And it's fully equipped. If you ever get the pleasure to go there, you make sure you stop and talk to John and Tom and Bill, because I'll tell you, they're hilarious right now.
Yeah, they're fun.
If you can appreciate just good humor and just good guys, and they'll treat you like you're a brother the first 10 minutes they know you. So I highly recommend that if you're out there on game day, just stop in and say, hey, can we go down to the tanks? And they'll know exactly what you mean.
I was taken to one of the games last year during Rockies Fever when they were on the pennant chase, and had the smoke beer. Fantastic beer. Yeah. It just blew my socks away, and I was going, okay, Coors, you did a very good job on that. Yeah.
They clean up at the Great American Beer Festival. I'm just always blown away, not only by some of the names that they come up with but for their beers, but just, you know, how great they are.
Yeah. I know secondhand smoke is what that smoke beer you're talking about. I know it won a medal. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you what medal it exactly won.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that the Salem this year won 5 medals for
which one?
Coors fan. Overall.
They won 5 this year.
5 medals. But I know for a fact that, thank you very much. Yeah. I know that they won. It's all those guys. They deserve all the credit because they're great. You know, I've learned since I've been here at Coors, Miller Coors, I've learned a lot about brewing from those guys, so it's very fortunate to be able to work with those guys.
Yeah, they are really, truly experts. I mean, there's no doubt.
So that's a little independent from the Pilot Brewery that you guys are running. What if they found something that really hit the baseball field? They'd bring it over to the Pilot Brewery, or the microbrewery, and then
part of the history of Coors, it's all about innovation, and I think that's kind of where you're going. And we'll never leave any good idea unturned. So,
right.
You know, when Tom and John and Bill Haas, we love Bill, When they come up with something, our marketing guys want to see it. I mean, these guys are talented brewers, and they come up with great products. And it's not, you know, they're almost wholly independent of really the big brewery up on the hill. And, you know, and they kind of like that. And we like that as well, because that just enhances their creativity. They basically have, you know, a free rein down at the ballpark. And we really like that, because they make some great craft beers.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to give you guys a hand. I know that Blue Moon used to be brewed in Memphis, and the Big Foamy Head podcast is out of Memphis. But that's the gateway beer that I turn my wife on to, so she really enjoys craft beers. She likes going to places and going, well, do they have a wheat beer like Blue Moon? So,
yeah.
You know, you guys have a fantastic beer right there.
Yeah. And,
thank you. I know that Keith, you're doing well with the Silver Bowl. And,
yeah, Keith, that was kind of his baby, and it's nice to see that one take off the way it has. So
yeah, Keith, there's no doubt one of the most talented creative brewers, if not in the world, for surely in the United States, undoubtedly.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
fantastic. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to welcome Dr. David Ryder, and you gave the keynote presentation. I would presume that's what you're calling it. We missed your presentation. I apologize about that. Would you like to do a little recap for us, or introduce yourself first?
Well, Rick, my name is David Ryder. I'm with MillerCoors, and I'm absolutely mortified that you missed my incredible presentation this evening.
I am full of apologies.
You know,
so sorry.
No. Just all seriousness now. But what I wanted to do, I gave a presentation this evening, which we call the Bitter Twisted Truth of the Hop. And the reason for doing this is because there's an awful lot of mystery and intrigue about hops, and there's an awful lot of magic. And the more we find out about hops, the more we can take advantage of hops to be able to create different types of beers. And that, I believe, is very important. You know, not only are we concerned about bitterness, which is, you know, of course, very important, you know, to beer, but we're concerned about the contribution of hops to beer foam.
Mm-hmm.
We're concerned about the antimicrobial properties of hops. We're concerned about mouthfeel. We're concerned about hop flavor, hop aroma. All these things need to be spoken about so that people understand them. And this is what I was trying to do this evening, to be able to put those things, those components, sort of into perspective.
We're all about IPAs how you trying to get as double IPAs and trying to get as many hops in a beer as you can. But there's also a lot of beers coming out these days that have a really nice balance. How do you see the industry evolving in terms of people's preferences where hops are concerned? You know,
for the past 20 years, Dana, for the past 20 years, I believe there's been more emphasis on hop bitterness than there has been on anything else.
Right.
And I believe that that's fine. And it's fine to understand bitterness, and it's fine to understand sort of hop utilization. But these days we know that many consumers don't want to have an overly bitter beer.
Right.
But they want to have a flavorful beer. And therefore I think that the tide has turned towards different hop aroma varieties.
Yeah.
And therefore I think the hop growers particularly are now certainly stepping up to be able to give us alternative aroma varieties of hops, which will give us alternative flavors and which will better please the consumer. And I feel very strongly about that. I've always felt very, you know, strongly about that. Bitterness is important, but it's all these other properties which now are even more important than this level of bitterness.
Yeah, so the finish hop.
Do you have any specific up-and-comers that you know of from maybe Australia or maybe South America or some of the other hops, new emerging hops?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think the intriguing thing is, and we're very lucky to have an active microbrewing industry. And I say that actually with deep respect, because it's the microbrewing industry that are going to do more experimentation than, say, the mainstream brewers, generally speaking. And therefore, they're going to search out the latest hops from New Zealand, from Australia, even those from the UK, as well as the up-and-coming ones from the Pacific Northwest, you know, the states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. lot of intense sort of activity now, you know, looking at those. And of course, there's the German hop industry, and we must never ever forget the German hop industry that has some wonderful hop varieties. And we see a lot of interest in again, more kind of aroma varieties there as well. Hopping, it's like, you know, it's like anything else. It's like while we're traditional brewers, and we all like to say that we're traditional brewers, but it's like there are exciting new flavors out there, exciting new experiences, and hops can add to that.
I know that a lot of the Americans have been misusing hops. Maybe Sam Calagione from Dogfish Head is one of the biggest offenders, where he continuously hops over 90 minutes or 120 minutes, and that's probably not an ideal hop utilization. Do you have guidelines that maybe homebrewers could use to get the most out of the hops now that the prices have gone up?
Well, first of all, I think that with the current state, or at least the state of the hop industry as it was, say, about 6 months ago, I think that, you know, brewers can take advantage of, say, pre-isomerized hops. That's going to give you much better utilization. Now, you can get pre-isomerized.
I'm not familiar with that term.
Well, it's where you have either a hop extract or a hop pellet, where the alpha acids in the hops have been pre-isomerized, so that rather than the isomerization occurring in the brew kettle, you can add those hops in a pre-isomerized form to the brew kettle, so you don't have to rely on the turbulence of the kettle boil. Or in the case of pre-isomerized hop extracts, you can add them after the brew kettle to be able to get better sort of utilization that way. So your point's a very good point, Rick, because there are ways and means of being able to better use hops to get better utilization. And 6 months ago, I would say the price of hops for 6 months ago was unbelievable.
Yeah,
and
it's going down.
Yes. And that's good. But let's not consider that the same thing can't happen in a few years' time again.
Right.
And so therefore, it seems to me that as we go forward, brewers should be looking at what's in their toolbox to be able to get the best utilization, to your point, the best hop flavor. You know, what are the possibilities? And again, what does a consumer want to be able to delight that consumer?
I've heard of experiments where people are actually dry hopping and then they're reusing those dry hops to get the alpha acids out of them.
And I've heard that as well. Yeah, it's just that's a very interesting practice, and it's going to be very interesting to see whether, you know, brewers latch on to that.
Personally, I'm interested in hop oils and hop extracts. I would like to get my hands on those. And I don't think that's readily available as a homebrewer.
Not for homebrewers yet, but maybe they will be at some point.
Well, you know, there are companies that do produce these hop oils, and which some microbrewers are using at the moment. And they can give you certain flavors of beer, which are good flavors. But sometimes the flavors can be slightly resinous.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to look at other ways of being able to use hops. I guess that if you add hops to the kettle, whole hops, you're going to get one set of flavors.
Right.
If you add the hop oils from those hops, post-fermentation, you'll have another set of flavors. So it's a question of what you want. But again, it gets back to the point that I was trying to make in my talk, that there are different ways of looking at hops, and there are different hop products out there to be able to have the greatest beers. And Rick, to your point, to be able to get the best utilization, whether it's flavor, you know, whether it's bitterness, whatever it is.
How do you feel about the International Bittering Unit?
Well, the International Bittering Unit is only part of the story.
Okay. I know people say, oh, this only has 60 IBUs, and I like my beers at 90 IBUs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is it a balanced beer? You know.
Yeah, it's all about balance. Well, to the point that Dana was making earlier, there are some great IPAs out there. In fact, we made an IPA about a year ago that had 70 bitterness units in it. It was great, but it's got to be balanced. We called it. It was a Leinenkugel product. It was called Big Eddie's Imperial India Pale Ale.
Yeah,
it was
Linus
great. Yeah, it was a super beer. It was just available on tap. It was a good beer.
That's right. You're mostly a Miller's guy, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
His background, yeah.
So, point being is, though, is that you're right, Rick. It's all a question of balance. You need the bitterness there for an IPA. You also need that residual sweetness. You've got to dial that in. But you also got to have the hot flavor as well. It's all about balance.
Right.
And I believe that today's cadre of microbrewers take an interest in producing much more balanced beers than we've seen in the past. Yeah. And I think that's great.
I certainly enjoy the more balance. I like a little malt background.
Yeah. I suppose the price of hops has maybe driven that a little bit, but I think it's, you know, your point is very good about the consumer. You know, our tastes are changing. I know I can't drink a double IPA all night long, you know.
Well, it gets,
I have a bomber.
Right, yeah. But it gets to Rick's point as well, that the more you can balance that out, even if it is of a high bitterness,
right.
You know, the more the consumer is going to want that beer, the more Moorish the beer will be, the more drinkable, the more sessionable the beer will be.
Well, and I think session beers are you know, coming very popular too.
Well, Dana, you're right. I mean, it's... And what we see with consumer choice is that many consumers will go through a cadre of different products during the evening, you know, because they want that choice. They don't want to be drinking the same thing beer after beer after beer.
Right.
That's fine. You know, I'm just an old-fashioned brewer, so I tend to drink more traditional, conventional products, you know, which
what
I like.
What style of beer is your session?
It depends on where I am and what I'm doing. I love a good IPA. As a matter of fact, you know, Henry Weinhart's, we've just come out with a Henry Weinhart's Imperial South India Pale Ale, which is a lovely product and which has received good press in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. Again, it's all about balance. Having said that, you know, so I do like a good IPA, but if I'm talking to people and socializing with, you know, people, I might go for a lighter beer, you know. So.
That's like an English bitter.
Yeah, I like a good English bitter. But, you know, over in the UK these days, even English bitters are very variable, very variable. A nice London Pride, great stuff. A good Abbott Ale, super. But there's a lot of variability in the brewing industry these days, and simply because... As we've spoken about, you know, the hop crisis, people changing recipes, things like that, you know.
Yeah.
Can I go ahead and say go Packers?
If you want to, thank
go
you.
Packers.
That's great.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Ryder. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Rick. Yeah. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks for
really
coming.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're joined with Steve Presley from Anheuser-Busch, Fort Collins, I believe, and you were at the World Brewers Forum, and I apologize for missing you then, but we've made up for it.
Well, Rick, you had a good excuse. You were drinking beer.
I was drinking. We were at the Great American Beer Festival, so we attended the first session for about an hour and a half, maybe two, and we got there a little late, and Jimmy Fixari from Croc was like, saying, you guys are late. It's like, I'm sorry.
Well, I think you missed a great, great talk.
I missed all the talks.
Excellent talk. And excellent beer, too. The Michelob Dunkel Weiss is just excellent.
You were talking about that earlier. I really want to try that.
Oh,
I don't know. Am I going to get a chance to try that?
Well, I don't have any with me, but it's on the shelf. It's out there, Michelob Dunkel Weiss. It is the recipe that I developed. It is a traditional Bavarian-style Dunkel Weiss. Everything from the malts that we use, the caramel, the chocolate, the wheat, and then decoction brewed, extended boil, imported, Hallertau, Tetnang hops, the Mittelfrüh hop in there, and then we brought
describe
in
the style for the neophytes in the crowd.
Well, the style for a Dunkel Weiss is it's going to be a cloudy wheat beer. You're going to look at flavors of the malt, not about the hops. It's not about the hops. You're going to get phenolic characteristics. The banana esters, the isoamyl acetates, and the clove esters. And those are all part of the brewing process. The clove esters come from the mashing in the yeast. The banana esters come from the yeast. And it's a style that's very prevalent in Bavaria, growing 20-30% market share down there. And when we brought that beer out, we originally brought it out here in Colorado as a regional beer called Ascent 54. Basically, to ascend the 54 14,000-foot mountains in Colorado.
Okay.
And we put together a team, or I put together a team of just beer people in our brewery, cross-functional team, lab people, utilities people, packaging people, brewers, people that never made beer before, technician, never made beer. We sat down, we decided what we wanted to do, and we made this beer. We chose a Dunkel Weiss, because it's not very representative style here in the United States yet.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we want to see it grow, and the beer, it is so true to its style. We took it up to some festivals, and people who had been in Germany came over and said, you can't do that. And I said, please try my beer. And they go, wow, I feel like I'm back in Munich.
I can tell you that's a challenge for the home brewers in the United States to try and reproduce that style because it's a very delicate beer almost.
You're right. It's a delicate balance of the flavors. You don't want one thing of that flavor, one flavor profile to overpower it. And it is a delicate balance. And I think we hit it on the head. Dana, you tried the beer.
Oh, yeah. It's just, it's dead on. It's you nailed it.
So we asked Troy Casey and Toby Eppert from Coors on, you know, kind of the process for getting an experimental beer from inception to market. Do you want to kind of address that from the Anheuser-Busch side of things? Or?
Well, it starts with an idea. We were fortunate in our company. It was doing a regional beer program. Came to us and said in Fort Collins, hey, make a beer for your market. We decided we're going to make a big beer. We're going to make a big beer because of our big mountains, and we wanted big taste. And we sat down as a group. I picked a team. There were 9 of us. We came up with this idea to do Dunkelweiss, a not very prevalent brand. We said, okay, how are we going to do this? Went out and we bought 7 classic German Weiss beer styles and 3 American Weiss beers. Okay. I tasted them blind, wrote our comments down, chose the 3 we liked. Took those 3. Tasted them again, we're sure we liked them, and then we analyzed them. Broke them down analytically. And from that then, I handcrafted on a piece of paper how to make that beer. How much wheat, how much caramel, how much chocolate, how much Munich malt to use, how many hops to use. All those things that a brewer does, like a chef does, to make the beer. We put together the recipe, we put together the formula, we went for it. And the first brew we made, dead on.
How many barrels?
700 barrels.
Wow.
First batch,
700 barrels. And that first 700...
It was a small
one. Congratulations.
Well, we actually made 2 brews. We made 2 700-barrel batches, and those brews were releasable as is, right then, ready to go. And we had the support of the company to do it.
Okay, fantastic. So initially it was a Colorado release, and...
Sent 54. People at corporate saw it, liked it, said, wow, what a killer idea for a beer. They grabbed it, took my recipe, my formula, and now it's gone national.
That's fantastic. And you've got to feel proud about that.
Oh, I'm very proud. It's probably one of the high points of my career. I mean, I'm in the brewing industry 34 years. Started with Pabst Brewing Company after I got out of college with my degree in beer and winemaking. Worked there for 3 years, and I've been working now 31 with Anheuser-Busch.
Where'd you get your degree?
UC Davis.
Okay. It seems popular tonight.
Well, it's not popular. It's just that's
it's one
where
of the few
I went.
Places you can actually get one.
Yeah, 4-year degree.
For a long time.
In Chicago.
Yeah, but for a long time, there was the only fermentation, you know, program was UC Davis.
Well, it's the only full degree program in the United States, 4-year degree.
Yeah, that's why there's so many of them.
And they tie it in. When you go there, you really are a generalist. You learn about pharmaceutical production. You learn about wines. I mean, I can still remember times I'm out there in bare feet, stomping the grapes, making wine. You learn about wine. You do distillation. You do brewing. All those are right on that campus. And the campus right now is celebrating 50 years of the brewing program. Started in 1958. This is the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a product of the California College Institution, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty good.
And how long has Dr. Bamforth been the AB endowed professor there? Do you know?
You know, I'm not certain of the time frame, but I'm going to say probably 6, maybe 7 years. I tutelaged under Dr. Michael Lewis.
Okay.
Michael was my advisor. I originally went to Davis to go into wine because I grew up in the wine district. I had friends in the wine business. My parents got together because of the Parducci wine people. They introduced them, and I was supposed to go into wine when I went there. And when I went there, Dr. Lewis became my advisor. He kind of got the hook around me and pulled me into beer. And I'm actually very grateful for that because I've been fortunate. I've been... In 6 breweries here domestically, and I work 6 years overseas in England, Israel, France, all across Canada, Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, Philippines, setting up Budweiser production for our company.
And you've been at AB Fort Collins for the last...
I've been at AB Fort Collins coming up on 16 years.
And you made a big announcement today during the meeting?
Yeah, I did make a big announcement. I am going to be retiring at the end of the year. January 1st will be my last day in the professional commercial brewing business.
Okay.
Moving back to Napa.
Yeah, moving back to Napa.
You are.
Get with family, wine district, kids, and relatives and such.
Any aspirations to get into wine now?
Maybe well, wine is a love of mine. And I have relatives that make wine up in Dry Creek, up outside of Healdsburg, and of course in Napa. So, you know, a brewer can bring some ideas to the winemakers.
Sure.
Healdsburg, that's where Bear Republic is, and you should be close to Russian River Brewing Company. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, you certainly will have no shortage of good craft beers to.
And I grew up in Ukiah, Mendocino Brewing. You know, Don Barkley's no longer there, but when my early days of brewing, I used to go over and help him and Mr. McAuliffe when they had New Albions. I'd go over and kind of...
The original
first microbrewer, craft brewer in Sonoma there. And I'd go over and help him with stuff and give him some pointers. And I'm pretty proud of that because they started a revolution or however you want to call it that's brought people back to beer. And that's what I think about this whole thing with the small brewer.
Yeah.
They're bringing people back to beer.
Right. And that would have been about 1977.
It was 1978 when I was helping him over there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in Santa Rosa, there's, as you mentioned, Russian River and 3rd Street Ale Works is out there.
Yep.
Ukiah Brewing Company.
Brett Cupwriter, who used to work for Doug.
Doug, yeah.
For Doug O'Dell. And that's right, my hometown. I actually have an original Ukiah Brewing Company embossed bottle. That's from about 20s, but probably 1915.
Is that right?
And Brett has wanted that. He's coveted that. And I told him, well, you know.
You can't have that.
Well, I can't have that, but maybe one of these days.
All right.
Yeah, but Steve, I wanted to thank you for all you've done for brewing in Colorado. And I think you've really had a lot to do with making Colorado the Napa Valley of beer.
I think you're overstating it, Dana, in terms
of the MBAA and growing our membership and the knowledge that you've shared over the years. We really appreciate everything that you've done, and it's been a pleasure to work with you.
Thank you very much. It's actually been my pleasure to do that. I believe in sharing knowledge. I believe in educating those I can, and my library at my house is always open to anybody that wants to come. I've got 200-plus books on brewing, the first one being from 1810, the latest being 2008. So I love it. I'm going to miss it, but it doesn't mean I won't go back into it after I relocate.
Right. Well, it doesn't sound like you're going to have a real quiet retirement terrorizing fish. You know?
As long as we can keep he and Gary Dick away from the horseshoes, and then somebody else might have a... But it doesn't even sound like you're not going to hand over the reins in terms of the horseshoes at the technical out-of-towner week.
That's right. What Dana's referring to is our Master Brewers District has a technical out-of-towner. And for the past 4 years, a compatriot of mine from Anheuser-Busch, which just recently retired, Gary Dick, he and I have been the Iranian champions for 4 years. And I've already made the commitment to Gary, the promise, that after I relocate, if it's before the out-of-towner, I will be coming back. And I will be throwing shoes with him because we are the champs.
It sounds like there are a lot of caveats on that.
No, we are no caveats. If I'm still here, I'm going.
Okay.
If I'm not in Colorado, I'm coming back.
Yeah.
Because we are the champions.
Yes, you are.
And they go down hard. And this last match, we beat everyone up at Dillon. We were up at the Dillon Dam, and what a great place up there. What great beers, and of course.
Let's take this opportunity to...
Talk about Matt a little bit.
Yeah, talk about Matt. What a sad thing. It just shocked me when I got the news of that.
This is a brewer from
Dillon Dam, Matt Lure. It was a brain aneurysm, but it was right above
his eye.
Right above his eye, and he was so ecstatic that we came up. He was just a man full of life and full of passion for beer. Young life, and what a shocker!
And to win that, he won a gold medal with his Sweet Georgia Brown.
Yeah,
as he was in the hospital.
Yeah, he never. I don't think he was ever really conscious. Of that he had won on that, but
a terrible loss to his family and to the brewing industry.
So really. We'll go ahead and dedicate the show. I know you guys dedicated the meeting to that.
I would appreciate that because it's true. It's true. There was a real beerophile.
Yeah,
there in Matt.
It started out as a home brewer, you know, I think he started out in the kitchen, you know, at some of these restaurants up there, and. You know, got into brewing, and he, you know, was a home brewer. So, know, this industry is just so diverse, or the backgrounds that people come from. But
the thing about this industry, we're all in it together. We're all about beer. We're all about helping each other. You know, and people will say, well, do you share? Yes, I share. I'll share anything with anybody.
Yeah.
Let the marketing people have the disagreements. But as brewers, we share. I mean, look at tonight. Toby took us on the floor out there, okay? We got to see some things, learn some stuff, bust his chops a little bit because we didn't get to see as much as we wanted. But it's all in fun, and we are brewers, and I reach
and I'm
out.
I'm sure that he's showing as much as he can.
Yeah. Oh, well,
corporate guys. Put the kibosh on
it. I mean, the last meeting we had at AB, we did a tour where we allowed people to taste Budweiser. Budweiser on the kettle floor. Taste the wort. Then go down to the fermenting cellar and taste the beer after it's been 5 days in fermenting. Then go into the lagering cellar and taste it 21 days after it's been aged on Beechwood chips. And then go into finishing and taste the beer off the K filter, off the Kieselguhl, the DE filter.
Nice.
You know, and we share that. We're all about sharing. Maybe next year.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I appreciate your time, and we may as well wrap this one up.
All right, thanks, Rick.
Thanks again,
for having
Steve.
us. Oh, Dana.
Been fun.
All right, you ready?